This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Clouds so swift, the rain won't live. Gate won't close, railings froze. Get your mind off winter time. You ain't going nowhere. Ooh-wee, ride me high. Tomorrow's the day my bride's gonna come.
Hi, Laura Hurwitz here, and welcome to Mightier Than the Sword on the Easy Chair podcast. I am joined by my wonderful co-host, Stephanie Spaulding.
Hey, Steph.
Hey, Laura. How are you today?
Good. I'm good. I've been having one of these days where I did a lot of cookie baking and a lot of listening to NPR.
Oh, excellent. Did you get to the point where you started hearing the same shows again?
Yes, I did, okay. As a matter of fact. I did. I've heard a lot about Hurricane Maria today. Mm-hmm. Last podcast, which was last week, we talked about Florence, Hurricane Florence, and we were going to see how that played out.
That's right.
And the good news for me personally is that my daughter in Chapel Hill did not get flooded out.
That's good.
They're doing okay. But I know there are a lot of towns not in the same situation.
Yeah, it's going to be a long cleanup, so.
A long, and it was a slow-moving storm.
Yes, I don't think I've ever in my memory seen something that was so big, such a huge storm that moved so slowly.
Yeah, and it seemed to circle back, and places that didn't think had flooded, you know, it turned out, the floodwaters, you know, came in, or rivers crested, and so it was pretty bad for a lot of folks, so I think that was one storm that they didn't overplay.
True. I think it was appropriately covered. Yeah.
And Hurricane Maria, I guess, was exactly a year ago from today.
Oh, okay.
So that's why he was talking about it a lot.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, that, of course, was devastating. Mm-hmm. And they actually read the names of the victims, single one.
Wow. No kidding.
So that took quite a while.
No.
But since I had a cookie baking kind of week, I did do a fair amount of reading. And I know we said we were going to do like kind of old school book reports.
That's right. We're going to report on what we've read. And I actually don't think I've ever written an actual book report. I think when I was in school, it was after book reports were like, you know, weeded out as not very educationally sound. But
Man, you don't know what you were missing.
Yep.
Yeah. Always the last line of any good book report is, if you want to find out what happens in the end, you'll have to read the book.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Every single book report, either I wrote or my brother or anyone I knew, that's how it ended. You'll have to read the book.
Yeah, book reports are just not assigned anymore because it's just such regurgitation of plot. Certainly nowadays, people are always expecting you to synthesize, you know, make some connections, do something else with what you've read. So
that's right. Or compare it to another piece of literature or something like that. You're right. I did not ever in seventh grade assign a book report.
No.
And also you're in class, you're reading as a class, and you kind of go over plot details and stuff in class. So it doesn't, wouldn't do anything to do a book report.
But we're going to do a book report today.
So
do you want to go first or do you want me to go first?
I want you to go first.
Okay. So over Labor Day weekend, we went to a book sale in Kent, Connecticut, which is a really cute town. And they have this book sale a lot. It's hosted by the public library in town. We tend to camp nearby there. So we are often there when they're having this book sale and they have a lot of books. So I was just browsing. I usually don't buy books because, you know, more books.
You have a lot of books at your home, too.
Yeah.
That is one thing
We have a lot of books. We've actually donated a lot of our books. But I don't keep a lot of books. I don't keep books that I've read unless they're like were a gift or something. I either borrow them from the library or listen to audiobooks. But anyway, I saw this book and it was $3. And so it was really looked compelling. And I didn't have a book to read that weekend. So I picked it up and the cover itself is what sucked me in. So the book is, it's called Dorothea Lange, A Life Beyond Limits. And it's by art history professor named Linda Gordon. And I actually did not know the name Dorothea Lange. Many people hearing this will know it, but you'll know her photography because the very famous picture from the Depression era of the migrant mother, the woman with her hand on her face holding her baby, it's just iconic.
Yes.
I saw the pictures, I thumbed through it, and it looked so intriguing. And I started reading in it and just blown me away. It's so interesting. Her life. She was born in 1895 and she lived until 1965. So she basically lived through the most compelling times of the 20th century. Yeah. So reading her biography is also reading a history of the 20th century. And she just experienced so many landslide events. As a young child, she had polio. So she lived with a disability from the polio. And then she grew up New York, New Jersey in the early decades of the century. And at like 18, 19 years old, she just moved to San Francisco. Basically on her own. Within a few years, she had convinced somebody to loan her money for a photography studio. And she, within about 2 years, she was the preeminent photographer, studio photographer in San Francisco and in almost the West Coast, because people would come from out of state just to get their pictures taken by her.
Wow.
So just reading the first couple of chapters, you're just blown away by the personality, the charisma that she must have had to
She did this as a single woman?
As a single woman at a time with no support from her family, at a time when it was very unheard of for a single woman to do that. And it would have been challenging for even a man to do it at that time, but yeah, she did it. And she just was very determined. When she wanted to learn photography, she just basically decided out of the blue that she wanted to be a photographer and approached people to apprentice with them. And she talked her way into studios and she learned the craft.
Wow.
And she just had this extremely prosperous studio business doing family portraits, essentially. And this is it. Also, you learn the backdrop of the evolution of photography. Photography is relatively young. There are sort of shifting schools in terms of like photography as just portraiture, and then shifting later in her career to documentary photography. So she was just, her business was completely thriving until the Depression.
Yeah.
And then the Depression hits and she has no clients and everything. By this time, she's like deep in the bohemian life in San Francisco, and she's got to figure out how to pay the bills because she's supporting her artist husband. Her husband was a famous painter. Well, kind of famous painter. And he didn't really sell anything. So she was really supporting her whole family. She basically got into this role that we know her photos from because she worked for the government doing this New Deal photography.
Was it the Works Progress?
Yes, exactly. So she was hired with many other photographers to document New Deal programs. And she also was deeply involved in activism. So she was hired to document New Deal programs, but she went out and basically documented the suffering of farm workers. And then that's how it started. And then she went on to document sort of Dust Bowl era farming. So if that's not enough, she goes on to live through World War II, and she was hired again by the government, by the War Department, to document the internment of Japanese Americans during the war. And her photography was censored, but it's one of the few documentary evidence of the internment. So, I mean, she was just there for so many big things. It's really astounding.
I can't wait to read it. Yeah. I really can't. And I thought maybe she was just one of these people who couldn't stay still, you know, just like had to be out and, you know, roaming. I didn't realize that she had a thriving business and then she basically had to, you know, pivot into something else. Yeah. But the social activism piece of it, she must have felt so much more fulfilled.
Well, yeah, but there was always so much tension because she was working for the government, but not really taking the kind of pictures that they were hiring her to. So there was a lot of tension. Later, she worked for Time Magazine, but got very little published because, again, the pictures she wanted to take versus the pictures that were taken that they would publish. So she certainly did not have an easy career because there was so much tension between.
And did she sell out at any point, or did she just kind of stay true to what she... It sounds like she had a pretty strong personality.
Yeah, she did. She was pretty insistent. She fought for what she believed. But when she was working for the government, she had no control, or she didn't own the negatives and she had no control over it. So she actually never saw her pictures of the Japanese internment process because they were under lock and key until around 2006. So she never saw those photos. She sent the films in, and she never saw prints.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah. That collection has been published by this author and another person, a collaboration, so I can't wait to see that collection of prints. But this book is beautifully done. It has a beautiful cover. It has a lot of plates and images throughout, so I would definitely recommend it. It was, I mean, that's a almost 600-page book. But I read it in just a few weeks, and it was just a real page turner.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
And that's not easy for nonfiction.
It's not. Yeah. And it's funny, speaking of book reports and stuff, when my seventh graders were reading Of Mice and Men, one of the things they could do was research different people who were working during migrant farming and during, you know, during the Dust Bowl, and they actually could study Dorothea Lange. That was one
of the
people that I had picked out. And it's funny, a lot of students were just so taken with the images. Mm-hmm. That's who they chose.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. She was very popular, but I didn't know their book reports or their reports must not have been that great because I didn't know any of these details.
Her life is really astounding. And there's this legend that she may have been responsible for picking the color of the Golden Gate Bridge. She knew people that were in on the planning and designing of the bridge. And she was there in that San Francisco community at the time. And there's a sort of a legend that she might have picked the color.
Oh, how cool is that? And that's a color that it was not
the obvious choice.
Not the obvious choice, exactly. And I know when I went to San Francisco for the first time as a kid, I was like, what? It's orange. But now, you know, you can see it in your dreams. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty amazing. Oh, Steph, good book.
Yes, definitely. I would just say such a hero. And such a way to become more knowledgeable about the history of the 20th century.
Absolutely. I mean, she basically had a front row seat on all of this.
And I think it's helpful in these troubled times to see how many real tragedies our country has lived through and perpetrated, and yet we have this resilience. There have been devastating periods in our history, big mistakes made, and yet the country becomes better and grows. So I think it gives me some hope.
I love the way you're thinking there. I really do. I didn't think you were going there with that sentence. I thought you were going to say that in these troubled times, it's good to know that a woman can actually...
That too. That too.
But no, that's beautiful. And we have gone through very dark times and we've come out.
Yeah.
So,
and also her life was marked by so much, you know, the period that she was working in. She could not have it all. And the book documents how she was not a very good mother. Her children were basically neglected. She would send them off to like stay with people for long periods of time, boarding, because she was a career woman. And at that point, there wasn't really a system of daycare.
Right.
And it wasn't common, I guess, for people to bring in like nannies. Like, now it's pretty common for people to hire nannies to live with or stay with a lot of time, but they would send their kids away. And so her children had a very complex relationship with her, and there was a lot of misfortune there.
So, I mean, this tells the story not only of her, you know, professional career, but, you know.
It's a story of women, too.
Yeah, and the choices and the sacrifices. Mm-hmm. My book report is going to be much simpler. Because I think I told you that I was reading two books. The book that I read that I really loved and I kind of want people to read without me saying anything about it is called Salvage the Bones, and it's by Jesmyne Ward, and it's Jesmynward. I think it won the National Book Award. It's excellent, and I just want people to read it.
It's one of those
cold
books. I'm not going to tell you anything else. Just go read
just
it.
Just go read
report
it.
Back.
Yeah. I mean, the writing is so, it's beautiful.
Oh, fantastic.
Just really beautiful. The other book I read that I was sort of more of a mixed bag about is called Brass.
Uh-huh.
And the reason I picked it up is because, of course, I listen too much to NPR, and I listen to a Connecticut station of NPR, and it's about Waterbury, which is probably...
Oh, that's why it's called Brass.
Right.
Got it. Brass City, Waterbury, Connecticut.
Exactly. So it's about a young woman, and I think it's somewhat autobiographical, actually.
Uh-huh.
But she is, I believe, Lithuanian. And she meets a guy who's Albanian, and she's working as a waitress in a restaurant. She applied to college kind of late when she was in high school. Her mother's an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. You know, she doesn't have a lot of guidance. And then she applied to NYU, which is a little bit of a reach.
Yeah, sure.
So she didn't get into NYU. She had to continue this waitress job and kind of like wait the year out and apply again. And in the interim, she hooks up with this Albanian guy who's married. his wife is in Albania and hasn't emigrated yet to Waterbury. Mm-hmm. And she gets pregnant.
Oh, dear.
So I was sort of thinking that it would be like, you know, she gets through this pregnancy and then at the end, you know, there's some kind of triumph where she goes off to college. I really won't give away okay. the entire ending, I promise, but it didn't work out that way.
The author is from Waterbury?
She's from Waterbury. Okay. She grew up in Waterbury.
Interesting.
And she grew up poor in Waterbury.
I know, like, driving through Waterbury, it's a very poor city. It's really, even today, there are so many problems. You can't drive through without seeing people, homeless people on the street, and there's just a lot of poverty. But I know also from driving through Waterbury, because I go there pretty often, is there's like a Albanian club, Albanian bakery, like there's a big Albanian presence there.
And they're very clannish. Yeah. I mean, they definitely stick together.
There's a place called the Albanian Social Club.
That would make sense. Yeah. And the fact that she's not Albanian is a little bit of a problem for, okay. you know, her family and for his family. And also the other big problem with her is his family knows that his wife is back in Albania.
Yeah, that would be.
And, you know, she's basically just the, you know,
what's the religion of Albanian people?
She's Catholic, but he is Muslim.
Oh, okay.
So that's another,
issue.
Another issue. One thing that I did notice, though, it starts out, you know, very energetically, and there's a lot of really cool description, and she's very funny. Mm-hmm. She's extremely witty, the author. But then kind of midway through, there stops being a lot of description, and it's almost 100% dialogue. Mm. And she's good at writing dialogue, but you sometimes feel lost in the world that she's created. Like, it doesn't feel real or concrete. And after a while, you begin to mix up characters. You don't know who's talking. Okay. She actually goes between first person and second person. Oh. And second person is like kind of a weird, I think that's a very weird sentence construction. You don't know, you do this, you do that. Yeah. You know, it just becomes very hard to follow. Mm-hmm. And I think that would be another problem that I had with this.
Is this her first novel, do you know?
No. I think it's her first kind of big thing. Okay. But, or maybe it is, just a second. She had a fiction collection. Okay. So that's right. This is her debut novel. Okay. Sorry about that. But yeah, and she's had a lot of things published in a lot of different reviews. And she has an MFA from the University of North Carolina. So I think she probably got out of her conundrum getting pregnant. Uh-huh. I think that whole thing, you know, worked itself out.
And do you know where she is now? Like, is she an academic?
She's an academic librarian and she lives in Athens, Georgia.
Oh, how interesting.
So she really got out of Waterbury.
I think it's interesting that she's now living in the South, living very far removed from that route, and then looking back to hometown. And that's really interesting. So perhaps the most interesting thing about the novel is that it's this, I've gotten out, but now I'm looking back, and a person reflecting later in life about the roots. I think there would be a real challenge in writing that. It must be bring up a lot.
I also wonder a little bit, like, how her family feels about
that. Is all, yeah, that's always a question I have when I read either autobiographies or fiction, quote fiction, that is based on, you know, or inspired by reality. How do the people who are close to the story feel?
Yeah, she mentions them in the acknowledgments, so I have to think that they probably said, hey, it's a great book, and you're getting recognition for it, and that's awesome. But it was not a flattering picture, and you just kind of felt sad for her and for her family and for their situation and for the city of Waterbury, you know?
For kind of story, I always wonder, why not just write an autobiography? Why make it a fiction? Why pretend it's fiction? Does it make it easier to tell the story, make it easier to fill in the holes, or what's the reason for choosing a fiction that's mostly real versus autobiography?
I think maybe so you can tell people who see themselves in the book or think that you're paralleling, you know, your life and their involvement in it too much. Oh, but
it's not you.
I embellished. You know, I didn't. That's not real. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen. Mm-hmm. But it definitely. She knows where if she speaks, you can definitely tell. And even waitressing, I am dead sure she was a waitress.
Sometimes you can tell with those descriptions, oh, that person, that's real.
Yeah.
It can't be makeup. You can't make that up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's very, very true. I do think it's worth reading, but I don't. I like when you describe your book, I can't wait to read it. This book, it's like, yeah, maybe if it comes out on audiobooks, you know, you can grab it, or you know, if you have some time to kill. Yeah. But and I would say the first third of it is actually quite good, and maybe now that I'm looking at this, seeing that she does a lot of short stories.
I wonder if it started out as a longer short story that she just like to, it's a real challenge. It's like, I think it's fair to acknowledge that it's hard to write a book, and it's hard to have a book that's even throughout the whole thing. So we won't, and it's her first novel, so.
Exactly. And I have
kudos to you.
Kudos to you is right. And Jeanette. And I also feel that, you know, she probably wrote a great short story about this. And then someone said, hey, that short story is great.
They loved it so much,
It could be a novel. It really just could be a novel.
Yep.
And she probably just spun off of that.
Yep.
So, yeah, you're right. Great first attempt, but it had some flaws.
And probably most interesting to those who have roots to the Waterbury community or Connecticut in general might find it especially fun to read about a place you know.
Yeah, I mean, she names streets, she names restaurants that I'm sure actually exist there. I think that Albanian club might be in this book, now that you mention it.
Have you ever noticed how many books have New Haven in them?
A lot.
Like, New Haven shows up in so many books, and you're like, oh yeah, they were here because they know about Mammoons or something.
yeah, and they're always around Yale, pretty
much. I mean, that's why people sort of, this is a crossroads for people because of Yale, of course, but...
And they always take the train or something.
Take the train.
Always, that Metro North. Take it to New Haven.
That's so true.
Steph, this was cool. We got to do this again. We really do. I'm going to my book group tonight. So
excellent.
I will, whatever I read this month, I mean, we could do another.
Yeah, sure.
This is so easy. Book report. I like it. Yeah. I like it, especially since you missed that experience as a kid.
I do have some catching up to do.
You do. You do.
How many pages is it? Does it have to be?
Okay, so next time, maybe a book report, maybe a would you rather.
Lots of options.
Tons. And we can see what happens. Let it unfold.
That's right.
Okay. So until next time.
That's right. We'll see you all later. And as we always say, write to us
at easychairpodcast@gmail.com. Please. We want to hear from you, and we mean that most sincerely.
Take care, everyone.
See ya. Bye.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.